The House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee is called to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Murphy moves the minutes for March 12, 2025. Are there any additions, changes, or corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted from March 12, 2025. First up this morning is House File 1662, Representative Rerauer. I will move that House File 1662 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Welcome to the committee, and whenever you're ready, please present your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. Good morning, everybody. So House File 1662 is an agency bill. It will allow the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs to better assist our veterans with connecting with other state benefits more effectively and more efficiently. It will amend state statutes so that veterans program staff can access the MACSIS database, but in read-only form. And MACSIS is a computer system that's managed by the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, used to determine eligibility for public assistance and services. So when a veteran comes in contact with MDVA staff in connection with a program like the Veteran Stable Housing Initiative and other programs in the agency, this might be their only touch point with that veteran. And this gives them, by allowing the agency members read-only access, they right there, while they have that touch point with the veteran, would be able to quickly and efficiently connect this veteran with other services that they might qualify for. So the bill is a technical adjustment. It doesn't affect the administration of benefits by DHS or DCYF. So we're just looking to ensure that veterans and their families get benefits and services in a more streamlined and efficient manner. It will reduce the time it takes to get assistance to those needing it. In addition, it's one portion of a common sense adjustment we can make in state statute in order to move toward ending veteran homelessness. We also have an amendment to share, and if I could turn it over to my testifier, Chair, that would be
Thank you helpful. For the presentation, Representative Rerauer, and I will move the A2 amendment that be before us. Would you like to speak to, give testimony through the amendment, or have us adopt the amendment first?
Adopt, probably.
Oh, yes, okay. You can adopt first.
Are there any questions to the author's A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Cole Trace, and I'm the Government Affairs Liaison for the Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to thank Representative Rerauer for carrying this bill. She touched on a lot of my points, so I'll just be a little bit more brief. HF 1662 makes changes to Minnesota statutes. It gives MDVA MACSIS access for the purpose of verifying eligibility status of applicants for the benefits under the State Soldiers Assistance Program, which is what it currently says. Upon standing, our Veterans Stable Housing Initiative and other programs under the agency's Veterans Program Division, it has become obvious that Veterans Program staff supporting at-risk veterans within the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative also require MACSIS access. I just want to touch on one of the important parts of this. It gives us the ability to leverage the efforts of other Minnesota interagency organizations via the access to streamline the process to verify eligibility and complete entry of veterans onto the Minnesota Homeless Veteran Registry, which is one of our main tools in working to end veterans' homelessness. It allows our staff to overcome the current information availability deficit to ensure veterans are connected to all available state and federal resources for which they are eligible. We can gather data to create proposals to address identified gaps for veteran eligibility for state and federal services and programs. And I will just finish with, at its core, this bill aims to reduce the time it takes to make eligibility determinations between federal and state benefits. MACSIS access allows the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative to identify those veterans not eligible for federal benefits and more effectively connect them to eligible state resources. This approach not only streamlines eligibility criteria, but also contributes to a more equitable distribution of resources. And as a result, the state's resource allocation becomes more informed, maximizing the impact of its initiatives. The expansion of MACSIS access to veterans programs will allow us to more efficiently connect homeless veterans to mainstream resources by ensuring they are screened for available benefits. This is a technical adjustment and will not lead to a net change in services provided or their distribution. And I'll just reiterate one more time that it's a read-only access to Maxis, which is somewhat of a tongue twister.
And one I've been enjoying up here since you stated it, Mr. Trace. Are there any? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1662? Seeing no one, public testimony is now closed. Are there questions for the bill author? Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. As a data privacy and protection professional, I appreciate that you emphasized is read-only. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to check in with the agency probably because the authorization for Maxis says may access, but then the authorization for the children and families data, it says you have to get an informed consent. So for any data that is being accessed, are we getting authorization from the individual? So for Maxis, it doesn't seem to indicate that based on this language before. So I just wanted to check in if that is more permissive, just to have access without the authorization.
Mr. Trace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and co-chair Noor. Do I call him that yet?
Yes.
Not yet.
thank you for the question. The consent is part of the MDVA-1 form that we have anybody applying for benefits within this. It states that Maxis is part of that.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we need to be more clear in the language because it says the commissioner may electronically access without putting the consent there?
Mr. Trace?
Maybe someone from DHS.
Yeah, this might be a better question for DHS.
Chair.
Representative Rebauer.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Knorr. So first of all, I want to say congratulations to Mr. Trace because he's just back from paternity leave. So it was John Kelly initially working on the bill who is now on a leave of absence. So he jumped in to take over. Mr. Kelly did share with me that before they, anytime that the veteran comes in and works with them, that they're filling out that form and it has to be filled out as step one and that the informed consent is a part of the form. So if we need to make an adjustment in the language, I'm sure it would be fine, but just so you know, it is an automatic part of the process.
Representative Knorr.
I see Ms. Graham.
Ms. Graham, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and help us with Representative Knorr's, Chair Knorr's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Knorr, Co-Chair Knorr.
We can just do chair.
Okay. Sorry, getting used to the change here. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. So this was actually DHS's amendment, so we want to thank MDVA for working with us. The intent behind this was really to just codify current practice and to make sure that it was super clear in law that that they are getting a consent from people, because if they weren't, that could potentially violate federal Medicaid data sharing laws. And as a result, there could be implications like penalties on DHS, or, you know, we could incur financial penalties with all of our Medicaid funding. If there are ways to better draft this, Chair Knorr, I can take a look at it. We did this pretty quickly because things are moving fast right now, but I'm happy to work with the bill author and with MDVA to make sure that it's as comprehensive as needed.
Representative Knorr.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I prefer that being clarified, so making sure that there's consistency between the systems. And also, Maxis could end up changing tomorrow, so I don't know if we can have a specific language that, you know, we can capture in that process. So any help will be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. First of all, do we have any staff who are in their 70s who will know how to use Maxis? No, never mind. Beyond the point. I assume, and maybe this is a question for Ms. Graham, I assume everyone who at the Veterans Affairs Office will do the same consent training documents around Maxis that talks about how to, like, what access you, how to, what you can look at, what you can't look at, all of the rules and the signature pages and all of the security that is in place with the department with MAXIS. I assume Veterans Affairs will collaborate to make sure those things happen.
Ms. Grom.
Mr. Chair, Christy Grom, Representative Hicks left too early. Yes, we would be happy to work with the Vets Department to make sure that there's all of the trainings in place related to data privacy.
Great, thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you. Just wanted to check in on that because MAXIS includes a lot of folks' information. So wanting to make sure everybody gets the robust training and get ready for weird binders.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Knorr.
Just a reminder, when you go to judiciary, I think you'll be asked about audit trails. So the same question as Representative Hicks raised. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Any other questions for the bill author or the testifiers? Seeing none, final word, Representative Rerauer.
Well, just thank you so much this morning for having us here and listening to and hearing our bill. And again, welcome back to Mr. Trace.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1662, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion is approved, and House File 1662, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
All right, welcome Chair Schumacher to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 2115 be laid over for possible inclusion, and I have an A1 amendment.
All right. All right, so I see there is an author's amendment. And then any, all right, here we go. Chair Schumacher, you'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment, and I have an oral amendment that I would like to move on the A1 amendment as well.
Please do your oral amendment. Oral amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the A1 amendment, I would move an oral amendment to strike lines 1.4 and 1.5.
So we are going to strike 1.4 and line 1.5. What was that? All right, nonpartisan, would you like to repeat this?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment is to delete in the A1 amendment lines 1.4 and 1.5.
All right. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Oh, yeah. There we go. All right, to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a cleanup. This whole House file, the 2115, is the department's policy bill. And so these were changes made to that. The oral amendment was just striking out some redundant pieces in there that just needed to be cleaned up so we could keep this cleaned up. And I would ask for your support in the A1 amendment.
All right, any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, motion prevails. Chair Schumacher, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to turn it over immediately to the Department of Human Services to discuss their policy bill.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services, and I'm joined here with my colleague Carrie Briones, and Ms. Didion will be coming up in a minute, and we're going to just do a brief overview of our policy bill. It's, believe it or not, smaller than usual years. I know there looks like a lot of pages, but It's pretty to the point. Most of what's in here is technical and clarifying. There are some policy changes, so we'll be sure to touch on each of the provisions. So I'm going to start with the first couple of articles here. Article 1 is the Aging and Disability Services article. And in Section 1, this provision eliminates what's called the Day Services Needs Determination. So this is a process where DHS works with counties and providers to manage capacity in communities to make sure that we've got enough day services in place and make sure that there aren't too many congregate day services. And this provision just removes the day services needs determination process for community-based day services, which we need more of. And we found that from lead agencies and from providers that this is really a barrier and just sort of slows things down for providers. We don't actually, through this process, tell people that they can't open day services programs. It's more a conversation about where the day service providers are located and making sure that there's appropriate capacity. So maybe suggesting that they move to a different region. So this just streamlines the process for those community-based day services. Section 2 is related to day treatment and rehabilitation rates for intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities. So for those of you that have been around the human services world, day treatment and rehabilitation, or DT&H, has become a little bit of an outdated term because in 2019 or thereabouts, we did day services reform where we got rid of that service by and large, and instead it developed a new service called day support services. We also have several other day services. One is called pre-vocational services, and then we have three employment services. So through that reform, we removed day treatment and rehabilitation from the DWRS, the rate setting for disability waivers. But there's one caveat to the service, that it is sometimes provided by counties and by ICFDDs, which are institutions that can't actually get waiver funding. And so this change just clarifies that the rates for DT&H at ICFDDs are the historic rates that we currently pay, making sure that we've got the appropriate spending authority. And so it doesn't change the rates at all, but if the legislature were wanting to increase the rates, they could certainly go ahead and do this. So this is really a clarification because of all of the changes related to day services reform, needing to make sure we had appropriate authority in law. And then the third provision in this area is related to waiver case management requirements. So in 2021, the department, and I think this really came from the advocacy community in large part, was directed to develop and implement a curriculum and training plan to make sure that all lead agency assessors and case managers had the skills and the knowledge to comply with informed decision making for people who use HCBS waivers. And this law also required that training and competency evaluations were completed annually by all staff responsible for case management and for disability waivers. And so that was passed in session law in 2021. DHS has developed this curriculum, and we're just putting this requirement, codifying it in statute so that it's clear to lead agencies that that is indeed an ongoing requirement because it's challenging for people to have to, no one would know that this is something that was passed in 2021 and have to look up session law. So want to make sure that people understand what that requirement is. And then the last provision in this article is related to residential criteria. This was another provision that was passed by the 2021 legislature that was really intended to make sure that we've got independent living options for people with disabilities and that we're complying with the informed choice provisions in 256B49. And so this essentially provision, it's pretty simple. It just cleans up a couple of cross-references that were incorrect. Happy to answer questions about that if members have them, but it's a very technical cleanup. Moving to Article 2, this is the behavioral health article. We have two main provisions in this article. The sections 1, 2, and 3 cover the first change that we're proposing to the legislature, and that is related to children's mental health targeted case management. And so basically this is just clarifying and aligning the requirements for children's mental health targeted case management with adult mental health targeted case management and our requirements in our state plan agreement with CMS. And so there's some changes that make sure that the mental health practitioner is allowed to qualify as a case manager. There's a definition of clinical supervision that we're adding that aligns things. And then it makes sure that that if the child or the parent consent, that case managers can complete a functional assessment which is something that's defined in the Children's Mental Health Act. So really just aligning things and making sure that providers who provide these services are oftentimes working with both adults and children, that they understand and have very clear streamlined standards for this service. And then lastly, in the behavioral health article, there's a codification of what is known as the school-linked intermediate grants. And these are grants that are similar to school-linked behavioral health, but they're delivered a little bit differently. So the school-linked behavioral health grants are awarded directly to behavioral health providers in the community, and those providers then collaborate with school districts, whereas the intermediate grants are, generally speaking, awarded directly to the intermediate school district. We have four of them here in Minnesota, and they serve different populations. The intermediate school districts are tending to serve populations with disabilities and higher support needs than maybe the school-linked grants. And so we administer these grants a little bit differently. And the school-linked grants, school-linked behavioral health grants are codified in state law, but the intermediate grants are in session law from, I think, like 2017. And so this is just making sure that they're clearly codified in state law, that the community and that DHS has clear expectations about what these grants are, what the eligibility is, and how we disseminate them. And finally, I'm just going to say briefly on Article 4, which doesn't have jurisdiction really in this committee, but just for members' awareness, there are some changes to technical changes to the prior authorization changes that were made last session, I believe, just clarifying some terminology that doesn't apply to our public programs, but does in the commercial space. And so that's Article 4. And with that, I will stand for questions or turn it to my colleague, Carrie.
Are there any questions? All right, we'll turn it over to the next testifier. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment, and I'm going to go over the Direct Care and Treatment article. Most of this article is a continuation of the work that the reviser began last session, along with staff from Direct Care and Treatment and the Department of Human Services, to identify and update statutes in preparation for Direct Care and Treatment, assuming its statutory responsibilities as a separate agency on July 1st. There were a number of sections identified throughout the statutes that contain various protections, duties, and authorizations that apply to Direct Care and Treatment while a part of DHS that need to continue to apply to Direct Care and Treatment as a separate agency. In the bill before you, where appropriate, Direct Care and Treatment or the Executive Board have been added so that once the Direct Care and Treatment assumes its statutory responsibilities on July 1st, these duties, responsibilities, and authorizations will continue to apply to Direct Care and Treatment as a separate agency. These sections do not create any new or modify any existing protections, duties, or authorizations that do not currently exist for Direct Care and Treatment. These sections simply extend the current statutory protections, duties, and authorizations to the new separate agency. This article also identifies several sections of law that were missed last session and were subsequently identified by the reviser where references to DHS or the DHS commissioner need to be changed to Direct Care and Treatment or the Direct Care and Treatment Executive Board. This article also contains several sections with technical changes and language cleanup, and those are sections 30 and 37, and it's modernizing terminology. And finally, this article contains several sections that do make substantive changes, including repealing several outdated sections that are no longer applicable. This is in section 74. And I'd like to note that in section 39, there is also substantive change. However, with the author's amendment, the extension of the sunset on the provision related to a medically appropriate bed for priority admissions under the prior admissions law will be changed to June 30th, 2027, which aligns with the recommendations of the Priority Admissions Review Panel. And that's all I have, but stand for questions. We'll turn it over to Ari.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions for the testifier? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to the next testifier. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ari Didion, Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. And I will be presenting on Articles 5 and 6 of our policy bill, which have policy proposals from the Licensing, Background Studies, and Program Integrity Oversight Divisions in OIG. So in Article 5, Sections 1, 2, 26, 27, 29, and a section added in the author's amendment relate to a proposal that would prohibit kickbacks in medical assistance and the child care assistance program. Currently, kickbacks are illegal in federal Medicaid law. And so this would make that, would put that prohibition in state law. And then it also adds a prohibition on kickbacks in the CCAP program. There is not a federal law to model this on, but several other states have implemented a state-level CCAP anti-kickback law. And so we modeled this on what other states have done. Sections 3, 4, 7, 12, 13, 15 through 25, and 30 are several policy changes related to mental health and substance use disorder licensing policy. And so these are updating and aligning with other areas of statute, reducing paperwork requirements, and kind of making small policy tweaks that we hope to improve access and improve the experience for providers. The proposal adds expands client rights under the Healthcare Bill of Rights to include children's residential substance use disorder treatment, non-residential substance use disorder treatment, and withdrawal management programs. Those are currently not outlined in the Healthcare Bill of Rights, while similar license types are. This also allows substance use disorder treatment programs to provide kind of a limited on-site child care without needing a child care license for short periods of time while their parents are receiving treatment. There's also some changes to reduce barriers to access for adolescent treatment, including exempting mental health professionals from redundant training requirements, allowing providers to use a comprehensive assessment that another provider has already completed, reducing paperwork for client transfers, and then clarifying about services provided in group settings. The proposal also adds timeframes for which staff need to complete alcohol and drug overdose, alcohol and drug policy and overdose medication administration training. Currently, there's not a timeline in statute, and so this just makes it crystal clear that they need to have that training before providing services. Sections 5 and 6 are kind of technical cleanup based on a previous change moving child care to a continuous license process. Sections 8 through 10 relate to Chapter 245C, the background studies chapter, makes a few sets of changes, providing greater transparency about the background study process. It also updates the arrest and investigative information that DHS is able to review. It broadens the term county attorney to prosecutor, and replaces county sheriff with a local chief of police. Replaces a county sheriff and local chief of police with a law enforcement agency, just to make that more general, to make sure we're getting the type of data we need for our background studies. And then it also provides for an additional limited set aside for people, for PCAs, I believe we already have the limited set aside for PCAs. So this just allows that limited set aside for people working in similar service types. So for financial management services, consumer directed community supports, and unlicensed home and community based services. Section 14 relates to guest speaker documentation and substance use disorder treatment. So there was an allowance for guest speakers that was passed in 22. This just adds some requirements to document the guest speaker that was used to ensure that the services were appropriate as folks have kind of interpreted this guest speaker requirement broadly. We just want to make sure that those are clinically appropriate services. And that's everything for Article 5. Article 6 is the OIG Children's Policy Bill. This mostly relates to licensing for services that are going to be moving to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families in June. So, and as I mentioned, there were in Article 5, there were a couple of cleanup items related to a previously passed change for moving childcare to a continuous license. This also, this article also contains provisions updating certified childcare centers, ensuring that they have policy and behavior guidance. It clarifies first aid and CPR training requirements. And it ensures that if they're on a conditional certification, that that is posted. So these certified childcare centers updates generally align with how we do things for other types of childcare. And then there are updates to the required child passenger restraint systems training. The Department of Public Safety updated this in recent years, and so this just updates licensing statute to reflect those new requirements. And they also, I believe, added more options for taking that training. So this just aligns licensing statute with the updated training. There are also a few, there's a technical change related to a previously passed change for child care centers. Previously, we had changed terms around their annual visits to make it clear that they did not have to be at the same time every year. So there is a conforming change in here to make sure that that is consistent across licensing statute. And then finally, added in the author's amendment, there are a few provisions related to child care development fund block grant, federal compliance. There was a 2023 site visit that found that our child care licensing was out of compliance with a few of these regulations. So what was added in the author's amendment were some no-cost changes related to these findings, updating training requirements for child care. And that is the OIG articles. I will stand for questions.
All right, thank you so much. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Didion, for the work. I just have a question about Article 5, Section 2, under kickbacks. I'm just wondering if you have an idea, what are the penalties under that kickback statute?
Thank you, Director.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I think it would depend on the case. If there were a finding of a kickback, that would be reviewed with any other allegations we would be investigating. But not Section 2, but later in the bill, there are sections that add criminal penalties for kickbacks. So I don't know if that helps clarify it. What's in Section 2 is adding that to CCAP statute, just saying that that is a prohibited practice. And so we would be able to take any administrative actions that we're already able to take related to fraud or misuse in CCAP related to those kickbacks. So we can't currently do that for kickbacks, but other allegations of fraud, waste, and abuse. So for example, like payment withholds, or if there are other allegations of fraud, waste, and abuse, anything up to referring that out for criminal prosecution. So I think it depends on what the penalties would be.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, thank you for the answer. So I see it's under prohibited hiring practices. Isn't this kind of after they're already hired? And I'm just curious that there's not any identified penalty for it or any type of reaction of what happens to the person if they're found to do this. So anything more you can add on that? Otherwise, thank you.
Director Didion.
Madam Chair, I'll have to go back to my folks around why it's under prohibited hiring practices, but essentially this just prohibits folks from providing an additional incentive to get people on CCAP to enroll in their program. So, you know, it'd be like if somebody said, here, I'll give you a gift card if you come to my center and not this center, because that that would be a kickback because they're trying to get somebody on CCAP to come to that program. And there are some exceptions, I believe, written into the child care portion. I'm not sure I could get into detail on those, but I could certainly follow up with more detail because I know some child care programs offer discounts and things like that. And so we wouldn't want those to get caught up in it, but I can certainly go back to my folks and get more information for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I think we can probably take this offline, but in the language, sometimes we say employee and sometimes we say bona fide employee, and I would like to understand why we pick and choose those two things. We can have that conversation offline because I suspect it's a more nuanced question. I'm just curious.
Thank you. All right, we are up for our next testifier. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Josh Berg. And I represent a nonprofit based here in St. Paul that provides affordable, accessible housing supports and services to low-income individuals with permanent physical disabilities and brain injuries. We offer integrated community supports, community residential services, and customized living services across various locations in the state. Today I'm here to address one specific section of House File 2115, and that is Section 4, starting on line 5.15. This section is a technical fix to legislation passed nearly 4 years ago in 2021. At the time, the chief authors hailed it as the best HHS bill we've seen in a generation and one that will greatly benefit Minnesotans. While I believe these intentions were genuine, some aspects of the bill have not aged so well, and this section is one of them. For those unfamiliar with this section, it added criteria for accessing residential support services and prohibits the commissioner from authorizing services unless the individual has complex behavioral health or complex medical needs. Additionally, the individual's service planning team must have considered all the other available residential service options and determined them inappropriate to meet the individual's support needs. Fast forward to today, to today, and we have a system that cannot meet the needs of the most vulnerable individuals across Minnesota. This system is searching for solutions to serve more individuals, but faces a looming deficit in the coming years. It struggles to complete assessments or authorize the services that Minnesotans deserve. It allows and even encourages a state agency to disregard state law regarding processing licensing applications and small changes to existing licenses. It operates in a vacuum, disconnected from reality and practicality. I appreciate the department including this technical fix in the bill, giving us an opportunity to discuss and hopefully delay implementing this vague and, in my opinion, flawed idea. I have many questions and concerns, but I will highlight a few that I posed in an email to the department earlier this week. The first one is, what are the definitions of complex behavioral health or complex medical needs? I couldn't find a definition of complex behavioral health anywhere in 256B. And then complex medical needs is defined in 256B, but it's connected to CFSS and PCA services. And I'm curious if there's some other definition that this is going to be tied to. Also, how will these be determined and what data supports these definitions? Based on the proposed timeline in DHS's bulletin from last week, it appears the CBSM will not even be updated until May, leaving less than 2 months for lead agencies, providers, and individuals and families to know how they will be directly impacted. The second question is, what is the cost to implement these new criteria? What will it cost the department to implement in today's dollars, considering inflation since the bill was passed over 4 years ago? What will it cost the counties to implement these changes? And what will the residential support services criteria report, also a part of the 2021 Omnibus Human Services Bill, cost the department in 2025 dollars? In other words, will these factors require a new and updated fiscal note on this bill? And third, with all of the current issues facing the system, why is the department rushing to implement this new criteria after nearly 4 years and keeping it under wraps until it appears in a weekly Gov delivery update? Is this an attempt by the department, the administration, or somewhere else to limit access and ultimately cut services that many individuals need and depend on? We have heard that the needs continue to grow, so is this an additional way for the administration to bend the cost curve and cut services for our most vulnerable Minnesotans? Many of us have questions and concerns about this language, and it feels like many answers do not exist, are incomplete, or are based on outdated data from over 4 years ago. I strongly suggest that the department pauses the implementation of this new criteria, or that you, Madam Chair, and committee members direct them to do so until stakeholders can work together collaboratively to understand and discuss the impacts on those who depend on us for support. Lives will be negatively impacted if this is implemented, and I hope you now understand the gravity of the situation. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, members? All right, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, if Mr. Berg wants to pop back up, just got a couple questions for him. Thanks for hopping back. So you had referenced there was an update from DHS that sounds like had some surprising information for some providers. And you had also said that you had sent some concerns and you went through those concerns. I'm curious if you've gotten any feedback yet from DHS on the questions that you had, or if we should maybe ask DHS in committee those questions today.
Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Curran. Yes, so the bulletin came out on 2 weeks ago Tuesday, or the 4th, and it included language about this new criteria. Full transparency, I wasn't in the seat that I am with the organization that I am, so I wasn't paying attention in 21 to these types of changes. So for however this got passed and for why, still trying to get caught up on the context of that. But the bulletin did come out and caught many providers by surprise and individuals with especially the fast implementation timeline. It appears as though it will start to be implemented in March with meeting with lead agencies and case managers to talk about what this will be. Updates to the CBSM appear to happen or plan to happen in May. And then June will be the last little bit of time to have some other discussions to fix or to come up with definitions or whatever it might be. I did pose several questions in the afternoon on Monday, and the department did respond saying that they were going to be working on it and providing responses to those, and that's where we're at.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you again, Chair. Thank you for that. And so it sounds like the conversations are ongoing, which is good news to me. And of course, we want to make sure that we get all of those questions answered before anything is implemented into law and could cause some real concern, not just for providers, but families. Can you sort of give us a little bit more on if this language were to pass as is, what would that look like for somebody either living or receiving services that you're providing or potentially for you as a provider? What could some outcomes be if this isn't changed?
Mr. Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Rep. Curran. The direct answers, I don't know. And I think that's the most confusing or hard part about this. There's so many unanswered questions, including the definitions of what is a complex behavioral condition or a complex medical condition. We don't know how this will really impact things, but what I can say is there are providers in the system right now that don't provide those types of services in CRS or customized living settings at the moment. So in my brain, as I try to evaluate this, and any openings that I do have in any of the settings that we provide these services is whether or not we'll be able to backfill or be able to continue to provide the same services that we're doing at the moment that we've done for the last decade, which means in practical purposes, which I think is sometimes lost on agencies, is if a setting is down one unit, we're losing money already. In these settings, we've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars just in 2025. So now we're not able to find somebody and be able to provide their services and backfill. It means that those other three or two individuals living in these settings are potentially at risk for losing these services. And we are already having ongoing discussions internally at Accessible Space of, if this goes forward and if we have openings, we may have to look to consolidate settings, which means that we'll have to reach out to the individuals that we serve, their families, their teams, and see if they want to move. And so we're going to potentially be disrupting everything that is their home, is the services that support them. And again, I don't know. And technically, this bill is a technical fix that is nothing related to what I'm talking about today. So in full transparency, this was, the door was open, so I jumped into it to be able to have this discussion. And I think that's where we're at. And I think we've seen this in other instances where we get surprise bulletins or bulletins that are sent out as guidance, and then come to find out there wasn't that collaborative spirit to it, and now the department has to backtrack. This happened a couple years ago with integrated community supports, and a moratorium was placed on, or a cap was placed on, the number of individuals to be able to be served in these settings. On a Wednesday at like 3:59 p.m., I remember it very clearly, and it was like, oh my gosh, how do we actually continue this new model, which we were told was the replacement for customized living services, and ultimately the department retracted that guidance, put a pause on that, and went back to the table to have those discussions. Now, in hindsight, as I referenced in my email that many of you received, it really didn't matter because the department hasn't done anything to start processing those applications anyway in the interim, so the moratorium is still in place, artificially or however you want to say it. So I think there's just so many unanswered questions that that is where my maybe perhaps overreaction in my email on Monday came to or came out as, but it is a fair overreaction, I guess, in my opinion, because I don't know the other side of where things are going.
Thank you, Representative Curran.
Thank you again, Chair. And a final sort of comment, or might turn into a question, I'm not sure yet. So it sounds like what maybe you're asking for and what providers are asking for is maybe some a little more collaboration before you might get a bulletin like that, where, you know, you had mentioned, you had a strong reaction to the information that you just got. And to me, that says maybe there was some communication that could have happened before, and not to put this, you know, entirely on DHS, because I've seen this happen with other agencies too. And when providers of other services and other categories where a bulletin will come out, there's a timeline of something, there's a big financial impact or something like that, and folks are going, oh my gosh, what's going on? What are we going to have to change? So I'm glad to hear that you're getting responses already. And I think I would just ask this committee and our body just to make sure that those concerns are addressed before before we lose the chance to make some potential changes for you that will alleviate those concerns. So I appreciate those ongoing conversations. And if you do need any of our help in those collaborative meetings so we can get this moving and get language together, please do let us know. And I think we're all happy to collaborate on that.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Berg. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions. All right, closing statements, Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just renew my motion that House File 2115 as amended be laid over.
Wonderful. All right, it's laid over as amended. All right, Chair Schumacher, we have the next bill before us. House File 2159 to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor? Oh, no. Here we go. We got to talk about it first. We're just going to move through it without even talking about it. All right. I'm ready. All right, Chair Schumacher.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 2159 be re-referred to the General Register after discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2159 is a concerted effort to root out ambiguity from our statutes. When I was going door to door this summer, I would get a lot of comments from constituents. They'd say, well, first, thank you for selling me a great unflippable mattress, but now we need to get guardrails on which external fixed payment rates are on performance incentives at nursing facilities. After a few town halls and public polling, defining the payments as cost payments proved the popular route with the public, and the stakeholders have agreed. And with that, members, I ask for your support.
All right, member questions. Okay, Chair Nahr.
Madam Chair, so with all that conversation of the doors, I'm assuming this is the vehicle bill.
Madam Chair, Chair Nahr, yes.
Thank you so much.
Any other questions? All right. What was it? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion. Okay, here we go. So now I get to say this. House File 2159 will be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye. Oh, I did that already. So we're done. Here we go. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
Oh, my goodness.
The final bill on the agenda for today is House File 1095, Representative Frederick. And Representative Frederick moves that House File 1095 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is before us. Whenever you're ready, Representative Frederick, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. So we're back again. I presented this bill before committee last biennium as well, and so we're going to take another crack at it. The idea is that we want to support people to be able to make decisions for themselves that impact their own lives, to have that autonomy as much as possible. This bill does not look to take away from that. However, we also want to recognize the complexity of situations to very briefly summarize that if someone is receiving services in their home, let's say for an hour a day, that service could be like trying to help schedule a doctor's appointment. So the caregiver calls up the doctor, says, I need to schedule an appointment, but nobody answers, so they leave a message. That caregiver, after that 1 hour, goes and does whatever else that they need to do in their lives. Well, that doctor, someone from that office maybe, might call that care provider and say, hey, okay, let's set up this appointment, let's do this work. Well, because they are no longer in that house next to that person, they have two choices. One choice is say, I'm not allowed to talk about this right now. Well, I'll have to call you tomorrow or the next day or whenever the next time is that they are going to be there to be able to help provide those supports. Or because they know that this might be the only window. Where's DHS? I'm sure they don't do this, but they might say, yes, I need to confirm that appointment. And it could be that simple. But they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be in that same space with the person that they are providing services to. And so what this bill looks to do is saying that they recognize the will of the person that's receiving services. They want to make sure that they are supporting them, but they can also say, we know what they want, what their intention is, and we're just going to do that on the side and get compensated for that time. Because if it's outside of that window where they're getting paid to provide care, they're not getting paid for working for that person. I guess at this point I would turn it over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Whoever would like to begin, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Ken Bentz. I'm the Director of Research, Analysis, and Policy for ARM. Back before you again today with another proposed change to the disability waiver rate system. And this is regarding House File 1095, which proposes changes to the allowed billable time for a tiered group of unit-based services called Individualized Home Supports, or IHS. These services are provided to individuals that are living in their own home, which is defined as a home that the service provider does not own, operate, or lease, or have any direct or indirect financial interest in. Currently, as Representative Frederick said, a provider can only bill for time providing one of these services when in direct contact with the individual receiving the service, either in person or remotely. We know, however, that only allowing for time to be billed in these circumstances does not reflect the reality of how the services are provided. A few examples of activities and time spent after client visits that are currently not billable include coordinating care with a case manager and an individual support team, assisting in health coordination, such as setting up or confirming medical appointments, assisting in coordinating housing, helping to coordinate economic assistance, coordinating and advocating for legal support. We're arranging for access to resources to meet basic needs, such as food shelves and phone and internet access. In these and other examples, providers report needing to sit on hold for very long periods of time, plus there are many instances of playing phone tag. Since the service provider has limited time with the individual they are supporting, staff then need to take phone calls at some later time when they are no longer face-to-face with their client. A lot of communication also happens through email. The provider may send an initial email when they are face-to-face with the individual, but it is not feasible to wait until they are face-to-face with the individual again, perhaps another week or two in the future, to continue the communication. So the proposal in front of you would change what is considered billable time for the IHS tiered services, allowing for some indirect time to be billed when specific conditions are met and only when an individual makes an informed choice to allow for some of their services to occur without direct contact. Now, we want to acknowledge that the current rate framework for these services does include a fixed component value called program plan support that accounts for some of the time a provider would spend providing indirect support. This component value, however, has not been adjusted since the rate system was put into place over 10 years ago and does not reflect the actual time spent or the true cost of providing these services given the reality of today's communication practices. So the changes that we are proposing are completely in step with how other unit-based services allow for billing for indirect time. For example, the three employment support services currently include the program support component that I mentioned, and they use this proposed methodology for additional indirect time. And also housing stabilization services, while not a framework service, allow up to 49% of the service to be provided indirectly. We know that life is unpredictable and providers need some flexibility to provide the level of support that people living in their own homes rely on to successfully manage their lives. Allowing providers to bill for indirect time will support individuals and their service providers in assuring the continuity of service and access to adequate support for their day-to-day lives. And finally, it's worth mentioning that while we have yet to see a fiscal note for this bill, we do not expect that if passed, it would lead to an increase in the number of units authorized for the IHS service. But it would allow service providers to be paid for more of the time they are already working to support those who use the service. With that, I have another testifier, one of our service providers, and I'll be happy to stay and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benz. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Larissa Beck. I am the Senior Director of Program Services at Reach for Resources. I'm here to testify on House File 1095. Reach for Resources provides IHS, individualized home supports with training, to about 85 people here within the Twin Cities metro area. This is a service where we can only bill for our direct time that we are working with the person that we are supporting, whether that's being done in person or remotely. The goal of the service is to be able to help people achieve independence in different areas of their lives as they develop their goals and outcomes. Recently, I had received a phone call from one of my in-home staff after she had a phone call with somebody that she works with saying that she was suicidal. She was on the phone with that person for a total of 15 minutes, which equates to $12.95 for that 15-minute phone call as the remote support for IHS services. After that initial phone call, she stopped responding to anybody. She stopped responding to her mom, her boyfriend, who are both her emergency contacts, her case manager, her arms worker, her employment service provider, and her housing worker. And we as a provider, are the provider for her for all of those services, the employment, the IHS, the arms, the therapy, and housing. So my staff then spent another 4.5 hours on the phone with all of the different team members, the police, her daughter's school, and MARC, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. She was hospitalized and ended up being released later on that day. My in-home staff needed to report the incident and do the full incident report out the team for the plan of the care for the day, coordinate necessary follow-up care, coordinate care for her daughter to be picked up from school that day since nobody else was able to get in contact with anybody else from the team, continue to coordinate services and communicate for all of the different areas of support that was going to be needed and necessary for follow-up. And since we do the arms, the housing, the employment, the, all of the services, luckily that communication was all internal. It would have taken much longer to do if they, we were working with external partners and external people within her team. So she was ended up being mad at her staff for reporting this because that's what she was going to do. And unfortunately, it's required that we do all of this work and do all of this stuff for her. So she refused to communicate with her again for the next couple of days. And my staff continued to try to be able to connect, tried to text her, tried to call her, but we didn't hear anything back. So all that we were able to bill for that one day was that one 15-minute phone call for $12.95. She had another 6.5 hours of work that she did on behalf of her for that day, and for that week, 12.75 hours of work, which we will be reimbursed for $12.95. If she would have called her employment service staff, we would be getting reimbursed $803.25. But since she has that relationship with her in-home staff, we receive $12.95. If we were providing that employment service for her, we would have been able to bill for all of that time, since indirect time for employment services is considered to be a billable service or a billable thing. All of that communication, coordination of care, follow-up, that's required for us to be able to provide. But since she has that relationship, and they had been working together for the past 6 years, they normally spend about 6 to 7 hours per week together, she felt more comfortable calling her in-home staff, which is completely understandable. So while, yes, the goal is to be able to help people become more independent and operate our services with those that we work with on a more individual basis and really help to promote that independence, days like this happen where we're required to be able to coordinate a lot of care for each person that we're working with. And for that 12.75 hours of work that we did, we're getting $12.95. So thank you for your consideration on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Beck, for your work and for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1095? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions for the bill author or the testifiers? Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This absolutely sounds like a common sense bill proposal. A couple questions I have pertain to HIPAA. Mm-hmm. So you're providing services away from home. Tell me how you have secure technology, and maybe so someone would not overhear a conversation, you know, a medicine to a pharmacy, patient name, date of birth, certain things like that. How do we do HIPAA in this case and make sure that folks' privacy is well taken care of? Thank you.
Who would like it? Ms. Beck.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. So for this instance, my staff ended up coming into the office and working from the office that day. She's communicating with the team members. We have releases of information to be able to communicate with all of the different team members that we're working with. If this is something where, you know, she would have been, who knows where she could have been, where she got that phone call, right? But all of our staff are trained in HIPAA. They excuse themselves from wherever it is that they're at to make sure that they're in an environment where it's okay for them to be able to communicate and talk.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And sort of a follow-up to Rep. Gander's question and your response. In my experience, folks who work on the provider side and do a lot of communications mobily from their office, like you described, from their cell phone oftentimes, whether that's issued from the provider or it's their personal cell phone. In my experience, there were personnel policies as well that specifically relating to HIPAA, saying that if you accessed any information or whatever devices that you use, you have to have specific security access, so you can't just not have a password on your phone. Can you tell me if that's similar practices at your organization? And
yes.
Ms. Beck.
Mr. Chair. Most definitely. All of our staff have reach-issued cell phones. There's password protection, encryption with our phones, with our computers, that at any point of time that they're out and about, they are working with secure technology.
Representative Kearns.
That's it. Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill author? Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask how was the indirect rate set? Do we know exactly what's the amount right now, and how is the indirect rate set right now?
Mr. Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Knorr, as Ms. Beck said, it's a unit-based service, so it's a 15-minute unit. And in this particular case, it was $12.95 for that 15 minutes. So if that had gone another 30 minutes, it would have doubled that. So that is the unit rate for that particular service.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So based on the last year's conversation, did we get an estimated cost added on to the IHS indirect support service?
Mr. Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the provider asks for a number of units for a period of time for each individual. And so they may or may not, they can use up to that number of approved units. They may not use the full number of units. And so, as I said before, we don't think that this bill, if passed, would add two of the approved units. It would allow more of those units to be billed over the period of time.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill will not cost anything if we're spending within the authorized units. Is that correct, the way that I understand?
Mr. Benz.
Thank you. We haven't seen a fiscal note yet. It will probably, again, add to the number of units paid or billed, and so expenses would increase, but it wouldn't change the forecast, per se. The same number of units, we believe, would still be requested.
Ms. Beck.
Mr. Chair, on average, for my agency, we do only unit-based services, and I would say probably about 65% of the units are utilized per year for folks who are on the waiver. So somebody will have 12 hours a week that's authorized, and on average, they'll use, you know, 8 or 9 of them. So this would just allow us to be able to then utilize those additional units that are currently going unutilized.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that, I think the utilization will go up, which means there will be a change in the assumptions of how much the cost will be. Is that correct?
They would still just utilize the amount of units that they have already authorized. So that would be, I mean, we set those authorizations on an annual basis.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get a clarity from the agency so that we're on the same page, because anytime you increase the utilization, the cost will definitely be going up.
Ms. Graham, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for this bill and help us with Representative Knorr's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. Chair Knorr, the House might be working on a fiscal note request. And I can't recall if we did a fiscal note on this in previous biennium, but I do believe that we would probably contemplate a utilization increase. And there could also be administrative costs associated with this bill. We wouldn't know for sure until we do a fiscal analysis and get that to the committee, but we do have some concerns around program integrity, duplication of services, how this might duplicate current case management requirements that we already reimburse for, and just in general, some like documentation and other program integrity requirements, so that might lead to some administrative expenses as well.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whenever you're submitting a request to the CMS, you're required to also include the cost. Is that correct, estimates?
Ms. Graham.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Knorr, I actually don't know. I would have to get back to you on that. Sorry. I that's probably correct, but I don't want to give the committee false information.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to getting the fiscal note and that clarification. Thank you.
Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Frederick, for bringing this up and not giving up on it, because I think it's so important. You would think that this is a common sense bill, but obviously we're here trying to get it moving. And then also a side comment, thank you so much for being here from Reach for Resources. As a former board member of Reach for Resources, I am so grateful for the work that you continue to do and you continue to provide to the community. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Momani-Hiltzley. Any other questions or comments for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. In my opening statements, I gave a very simplistic example of scheduling a doctor's appointment. What you heard from testimony today, though, too, is it can get much more complicated than that. And so I'm hopeful that this year might be the year, maybe, that we could get this done. So I just appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
All right. With that, House File 1095 is laid over. And that concludes the agenda for this week. Representative Knorr, anything for next week?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As of next week at 8:15, we'll be here on Tuesday. We have got several bills scheduled, so we look forward to coming back this same room at 8:15. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.